I'm Ted Seides, and this is Capital Allocators. This show is an open exploration of the people and process behind capital allocation. Through conversations with leaders in the money game, we learn how these holders of the keys to the kingdom allocate their time and their capital. You can join our mailing list and access premium content at capitalallocators.com.
All opinions expressed by Ted and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Capital Allocators or their firms. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Capital Allocators or podcast guests may maintain positions in securities discussed on this podcast.
My guest on today's show is Blythe Masters, founding partner of Motive Partners, a $6 billion specialist private equity platform that builds, backs, and buys technology companies that enable the financial services industry. Blythe spent 27 years at JP Morgan, starting as a teenager and rising to the firm-wide executive committee. Her path included roles as the head of global commodities, head of corporate and investment bank regulatory affairs, CFO of the investment bank, head of the global credit portfolio and credit policy and strategy, and head of structured credit. Our conversation covers Blythe's career trajectory at JP Morgan across asset classes, cycles, and crises. We then turn to the investment model at Motive and themes in asset and wealth management. We recorded this conversation on the iConnections Global Alts podcast stage, which explains the occasional wind gusts, airplanes overhead, sirens, and children playing in the background. Before we get going, this week it's time to spread the word about a new children's book written by Sarah Samuels from NEPC called Braving Our Savings, alongside a movement she started to promote it called 30 Seconds of Bravery. And Sarah's here to tell you more. So, Sarah, what's this project all about?
It's really about a few really important themes that I want to spread the word about. One is that the power of capital is tremendous, and we can do lots of good things with this capital that we're all stewards of. The other is the importance of role models and education. And then finally, being brave. So those are pretty generic, but these are things that I've spent the better part of my career learning more about. And I've decided that it's time to give everything that I've learned away. And the way that I'm doing that is I've written a children's book and started a movement.
So how'd you come about the idea of writing a children's book?
So I really shouldn't be successful in this industry. The odds were not in my favor. I came from a family that had generations-long cycles of making ends meet and really a corroding thread of fear handed down for hundreds of years. We didn't have any inns. We didn't have any connections, very little in the way of financial education. I started my career as an administrative assistant at Wellington Management Company. I was a state school kid with a German degree. And so by all measures, that really wasn't setting me up for success in the investment industry. But here I am today, a partner overseeing over $1.5 trillion in capital. And I really believe that other children should have the opportunity to have this life-changing experience of learning about money and entering the investment industry. The turning point in my career was about 18 months into my career when I realized that the woman who I had admired, named Jean Hynes, who was a very talented investor, who commanded the room, who was young, who was super successful, she started as an administrative assistant as well. The light bulb went off. I believed that I could. I had a tangible role model that I could follow, and I went and got education. So that's what this book is trying to do. I taught my two daughters earlier last year how to invest. We did stock research together. They entered their own trades. And my six-year-old came down after she bought her trade the next morning and said, "Mama, I'm going to make my own lunch today. I'm an investor now." And I saw that these children really are primed and hungry for this type of information. But financial literacy is not something that's widely required at public schools. It really needs to be done at home, and it's not always.
So you've started to get a bunch of really interesting endorsers of this book. So how's that all happened?
Well, it's been really heartening because I've put this message out into the world without much of an agenda or a plan. It's been a bit of a leap of faith that if we put something like this into the universe, and by the way, the vision is that we want to inspire and teach children of all backgrounds how to invest and be brave. Put that message into the world, asked a few people if they would support it, and they jumped in. right in with both feet. And so we have some amazing endorsers, including yours truly, Ted. We have a famous former poker player in Annie Duke. We have the professional sports community. So Alex Rodriguez and John Jones from the New England Patriots and Kyle Arrington, who's a Super Bowl champ, and powerhouses, industry powerhouses like NASDAQ. So this has been really heartening.
You mentioned bravery and this movement, 30 Seconds of Bravery. How is that tied into the book?
It's tied into the book because you can't be brave without doing something that you're scared of. You can't be brave without being scared. And so how many times have any of us felt scared to do something or take a risk or be uncomfortable and decided not to do that thing? So one thing that I guide people earlier on in their career is just do the hard thing for 30 seconds. It doesn't need to be an entire day or a lifetime of doing the hard thing. Just ask for the promotion, ask for the raise, make the change, whether it's in your personal life or professional. And I guarantee you it'll change the path of your life, that 30 seconds. So I can count to about 3 or 4 examples in my life where it's changed.
How can we help you spread the word?
Yes. Well, my call to action is to join the movement by embracing this idea of 30 Seconds of Bravery. It's to buy a kid a book or donate a book. And more information can be found on our website, which is 30secondsofbravery.org. And to be brave yourself and share the knowledge that you have about the investment industry with that next generation or with people who don't know as much as you do. There are lots of ways to be brave and to lift others up. It could be your time, talent, or treasure, but I really encourage you to get involved. My ultimate goal is to give the book away. So I've purchased 2,500 books to give to nonprofits and children who really need this education. And any profits that we make on book sales will be recycled into giving more books away.
Well, fantastic. Thanks so much for spreading the word about braving our savings and 30 Seconds of Bravery.
Thank you, Ted.
Please enjoy my conversation with Blythe Masters.
Blythe, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You famously got to Wall Street very early in life. I'd love to hear, what was your path to getting there?
In 1987, when I was 12, maybe, I finished school. And I took a gap year, which was common between high school and university. And I needed to earn some money and I wanted to travel. And so I wrote cold call letters to a number of banks in the city of London. And at that time, I didn't really know the difference between a commercial bank or an investment bank or merchant bank. I got 2 job offers as a result of these letters, one of whom was from Continental Illinois. They died an ignominious death not very long afterwards. Yes. The other was Morgan Guaranty Limited, which was the predecessor to what is today JP Morgan. And I first worked for JP Morgan when I was still a teenager, before I went to university, did a gap year. And then every year thereafter, while I was at university, I came back and did summer internships. And so in 91, when I graduated with a degree in economics from Cambridge, I joined JP Morgan permanently. It was a foregone conclusion at that stage. They knew me pretty well and I knew them pretty well. And I loved what I was doing there.
Where did they put you with 5 years' experience coming out of college?
What's more interesting is where they put me with no experience on day one. And the answer to that was the photocopy machine. Because remember, this is pre-email, pre-networked computers, and photocopying was a big part of life. So I did that for a while. Then they realized that I actually could read the contents of the documents I was photocopying. And I started working on the confirmations of derivatives and the accounting for and valuation of derivatives. In 1987, derivatives were very new. The first swaps, I think, were executed maybe 83, something like that. Still a very novel concept, and they were accrual accounted for. And so the shift from accrual accounting to mark-to-market accounting, which sounds pretty arcane, but in banking accounting terms, it was a seismic shift and produced some very large swings on the income statement. So it needed forensic analysis. And so I got taught how to value and structure and mark-to-market swaps at the age of a teenager. And that's where I first landed.
What was your early path at, well, then Morgan Guaranty?
When I graduated and joined full-time, I joined the Global Commodity Derivative Group, which consisted, I think, of about 4 people and me. I was the only girl or woman. The bank had been in the business of bullion and related precious metals for many decades, but this was the beginning of our work in providing hedging instruments in things like jet fuel and oil and other energy-related products. Over the course of many years, I spent a lot of time in and around the derivative markets, almost all of them, from rates, credit, commodities, environmental commodities, and built and ran what became big franchise markets businesses for the firm, the structured credit business in the 90s. And I then moved back into commodities in the 2000s and built out the physical as well as the derivative business in commodities. Then I also did tours of duty in risk and control functions. I looked after a global credit portfolio that manages all of the loans and counterparty exposure from derivatives that the bank retains. In the era after Jamie joined the firm with the combination with Bank One, became the CFO of the Global Investment Bank, working for then CEOs Bill Winters and Steve Black. In the aftermath of the great financial crisis, there was a wave of re-regulation and changed regulation, and I acted as the head of regulatory affairs for the investment bank while doing my day job in commodities in order to help navigate all of that change.
There's a lot over that time horizon that we could unpack. One of the most interesting things is whether it's commodities, credit, you've been through a lot of cycles. What did you see about how you go about managing through a cycle in an increasingly large organization?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And to put that in context, when I joined Morgan Guaranty, which was 87, it was still a AAA rated institution. I think it had about 12,000 people globally. So compare that to the behemoth that it is today. It's an extraordinary period of change. And I stayed with the firm for, in total, 27 years. So it was unrecognizable by the end. And you're right that during that time, there were many cycles that came and went. There were many crises, specific individual events, as well as broader market cataclysms, obviously 2008 being the most significant of those. But interestingly, I think the first that I was really in a position where I was senior enough to have any perspective to really learn from it was what happened at the time of 2001, which was when the first wave of the dot-com bubble burst. And there was the meltdown in the merchant energy space, Enron and others, significant sell-off in high-yield credit markets and private equity, which until that point had been thought to be diversifying of each other. They proved definitely not to be. JP Morgan did not come out of 2001 covered in glory. JP Morgan came out of 2001 very much at the bottom of the pack. And the reason for that had to do with the extent of the retained credit positions in leverage and high yield credits and associated private equity exposures as well. I assumed the role as head of global credit portfolio management in 2001, more or less exactly, with Enron and WorldCom, all these things unfolding around us. And it was the lessons that we took from that, which had to do with being much more cautious about retained exposure in the portfolio, much more proactive in the use of instruments like securitization, like credit derivatives, to manage down retained credit exposures, much more focus on things called wrong way risks, things that correlate with each other in the worst way at the worst time, and getting sophisticated about the tools to manage those. All of that combined with what I think, frankly, was just a great judgment call on the part of Jamie and the executive management team at JP Morgan later in 2006 and 2007 in avoiding the subprime home equity lure, the trap. Super extraordinary volumes of activity in that space by many people that were eroding JP Morgan's market share. But we stayed out of that because of the lessons we'd learned from that prior period and because Jamie and others had a very early negative view on the risks in that space. There are two phrases that if you scratch it, a longtime JP Morgan person, they'll come out with is that the mantra is you run a fortress balance sheet, you seek to do first-class business and that in a first-class way. And if I learned two things over the course of being trained over many decades as a banker, it was those two things that I think are most ingrained. And they're small sentences, but they're big concepts. They describe a cultural orientation and a way of doing business and a way of looking after the consequences of doing business and the responsibility that you have for that. Those things were super, super emphasized at every possible opportunity by the leadership of the bank. And it began before Jamie, to be fair, but he certainly, I think, took it up a notch. You say, what does a fortress balance sheet mean? Obviously, you have to trade things off. Doing no business at all is pointless, but it has many dimensions, relates to liquidity and capital and stress testing and thinking about crowded trades and wrong way risks and what is the herd doing? And is it safe to follow the herd today, or is it dangerous? And just because everyone else is doing something, does that mean you should be doing it? It means, what does this mean for your clients? What does this mean for your reputation? The notion that a reputation can take decades or even centuries to develop and can be destroyed in a minute. These are the notions that I think I absorbed over many years, and I think really are a big part of the reason why JP Morgan is what it is today.
When you're sitting in that seat of running that credit business, say even 2001, when you come in and you have that idea, want to have a fortress balance sheet, want to do business in a first-class way, there are a lot of people underneath you. There are traders running risk. There's different exposures. There's different dealers. What do you actually do on a day-to-day basis to oversee that aspect of risk?
It's a good question. There's the explaining the strategy, and then there's giving people the tools to execute the strategy. Both are equally important. It's very clear to have a strategic orientation in your business, especially if you're not in a steady state. So you're evolving in a direction, which in 2001, JP Morgan absolutely was not a top tier investment bank. It had certain areas of excellence, but it had a long way to go to become what it became through the course of the financial crisis. What we did in terms of giving people the tools, we got a lot more granular and specific in terms of transfer pricing and pricing of risk in particular. So we dropped concepts of revenue targets or growth targets or volume targets or market share targets. You have to pay attention to those. But we introduced the notion of capital consumption, SVA, shareholder value added, and models to estimate what are the resources of the bank that are consumed by any given activity. And then we got very rigorous about evaluating what is the client value proposition. We always know how a client values the business we provide to them, but how does the bank need to value the business a client brings to us? And if a client is very concentrated in a single product line, and that being unsecured lending, for example, very hard to achieve the return on equity that is appropriate to not destroy shareholder value at a bank. And that was true then, and it's true multiple fold today because capital requirements have increased. The idea is you need to create the incentive to have customers become customers of multiple product lines, and you need to track all of that and hold your people that are responsible for those client relationships from really understanding what a client P&L means, and a capital risk adjusted client P&L really means what is the return on customer capital that has been consumed by that customer. And those were the metrics that we introduced and are still used, and I'm sure have been evolved immeasurably.
If you were to compare a bank, a financial services company, the balance sheet, shareholder value added to a simpler asset management structure. Think about an asset manager, a hedge fund who's generating returns. How would someone who's used to the asset management business think about what the rates of return the bank is trying to generate?
It's interesting that so many of the world's great banks have diversified into asset management and wealth management, which is a similar type of business in terms of return on equity that it can generate. The difference is that in asset management business, you're not deploying leverage in your company, typically. Or if you are, it's very well prescribed and defined within the parameters of a particular instrument or product or fund. Banks are leveraged institutions, and you never forget that. And that's why this concept of fortress balance sheet matters, because if you inject leverage into the equation and your deposits, for example, can disappear for a reason, as we saw in the regional banking crisis last year, and you have assets that are not short-term and liquid, then you can create a mismatch there, a maturity mismatch, a liquidity mismatch, that even if the underlying performance of the assets is okay, which was the case during the regional banking crisis, you have a problem with just managing the liquidity there. In an asset management business, you don't have that. It's typically a real money business and very often much less leverage. And obviously certain parts of the spectrum within asset management, the hedge fund space, do deploy leverage to varying degrees, but it's a very different construct and they typically stay much more liquid. Or they tie the instrument by the investor to the tenor of the activity or the liquidity horizon of the activity that they're undertaking. So in private equity, you put your money in, you don't expect to get it back tomorrow morning. And if you do, that's going to be painful. It's a long-term investment. And as part of a diversified portfolio, that makes sense. So that's the basic difference. It's one word. It's leverage, really.
And how does that change the market activity? So if you're thinking about running that credit business, the people who are taking risk or have risk on their balance sheet are owning the same instruments that a real money owner will have.
What's changed very significantly over the last period since the great financial crisis is the amount of capital that is required to be held per unit of risk on a bank's balance sheet. The formulae are complex and there's many of them, but bottom line is that it's boiled down to more capital required for pretty much everything. The result of it is that the bank-driven appetite for assets has declined, relatively speaking. And what has moved into that space are alternative credit providers. So broadly speaking, it's known as the shadow banking system, but the big private credit and equity funds and hedge funds and insurers and others who are increasingly directly providing capital markets capacity to what was traditionally the world of banking clients. The objective of the bank regulators in doing this is that they wanted to reduce the leverage in the banking system because of the lessons learned from the financial crisis. And they're effectively, purposefully pushing that capacity out of the system without having necessarily satisfied themselves or everyone that there's sufficient alternative capacity to make up for that. And there's a concern that this is raising the cost of access to both credit and liquidity for everyone. It really remains to be seen whether the overall effect on capacity of the system to provide the engines of growth in capital markets, whether the equilibrium that we end up with is one that is healthy for growth in the long run.
So one of the other aspects of your long tenure at JP Morgan was a series of corporate strategic acquisitions. Would love to learn what you learned about what works and what doesn't in corporate M&A.
Many things is the answer. And I did a lot of M&A, both acquisitions and divestitures that I was responsible for, but I was also the subject of a few of them. So when Chase acquired JP Morgan, I was on the JP Morgan side and so on. So I've seen it from the inside as well. And I think what I would say I've learned is that it is almost without exception, it's all about the execution. And that matters almost more than what it is that you're buying and why it is you're buying, because something that is a great business that you're buying for all the right reasons can fail if the integration isn't done right. And I remember an interview that I think Jamie did, actually. The journalist asked him, so what was the hardest thing about the Bank One JP Morgan Chase merger? And Jamie said, without missing a beat, the JP Morgan Chase merger. And the guy goes, no, I was asking about the Bank One. And Jamie goes, no, it was the JP Morgan Chase merger because it wasn't finished. 4 years on, it wasn't done. His first job wasn't integrating Bank One and JP Morgan Chase. It was integrating JP Morgan Chase. That really matters. And that has cultural dimensions, people dimensions. It's making tough decisions, not leaving every business with a co-head because you're too timid to make the tough decision, making difficult infrastructure decisions so that you don't end up with a fragmented estate technology-wise. All banks that have grown via acquisitions have legacy tech debt problems that are significant, and very often those derive from not taking the tough decisions sooner, and then you just create a sort of spaghetti junction, string and sellotape, hold the whole thing together, and that ends up causing cost inflation over time, but inability to eliminate cost over time. So there's a big technology component to doing acquisitions. But really making an acquired business feel welcome and integrated and getting the knowledge centers flowing through the organization, which is what leads to client success, is the hardest thing to do, I think, and very much where the art of doing mergers comes from.
So after what anyone would consider an entire lifetime at JP Morgan, you did leave.
I did leave, yes.
I would love to hear a little bit about your journey that then led to Motu.
So if you think about what I did at JP Morgan over the years, I didn't stay in any one spot for that long. Maybe 3 years was probably the longest. And kudos to the firm that they took young executives and deliberately tried to stretch them with new assignments and opening horizons. And so I did a lot of different things at JP Morgan that involved building new capabilities. So when it came time to leave JP Morgan, which I did because we sold the physical commodities business that I was then running, I didn't wish to travel with the business. And I could have stayed with the firm, but I realized if I did, I was going to be a lifer. And I had an itch entrepreneurially that I wanted to scratch. I also had a suspicion that even though I thought of myself as an innovator within the fabric of JP Morgan, innovating with such an enormous safety blanket around you and a whole legion of people who are there to make sure you don't screw it up doesn't necessarily count as being really entrepreneurial. So that's what led me to open my mind to doing something different at that time. And also I had developed a point of view that was the bank and every bank necessarily had been very inwardly focused in the period from 2008-09 onwards. And it had to do with regulatory reform and the many scandals and big settlements that had to be worked through. And it was really a period of existential crisis for banking. And meanwhile, the same year that began, this little thing called the smartphone came to the world, and that spawned an unbelievable explosion of innovation that was largely ignored by the banking sector for a few years. It got to the point where, okay, maybe there were mobile banking apps being deployed. I wasn't really on the ball. So what was going on was the development of new technologies fueled a new category of people that were chipping away at the competitiveness of the banking sector with non-bank charters, in many cases completely unregulated, all leveraging technology to do it. And so this was the thing that is fintech. And I developed a point of view that this was somewhere on the spectrum between scary and very exciting, depending on where you sat, and that it was underappreciated by my industry. And that and the urge to do something more entrepreneurial is what led me to move. That led to Digital Asset, which was a very early mover in the enterprise blockchain space before that became a thing. And I had watched with interest and some skepticism, I might add, the cryptocurrency movement, if you want to call it that, but was very interested in the technology behind Bitcoin and its potential for revolutionizing the way that banking and other business involving multi-party processing could get conducted. And that I did for 4 years, from ground zero, no revenue, no pitch book, no clients, no capital, through several rounds of funding and our first customers contracted. And then the job became an enterprise software delivery job, which I wasn't best suited to really do. I have no particular skills in that area. And I then took a year off, having spent a lot of time traveling the world, did a lot of business in Australia, Hong Kong, Western Europe, whilst being based in New York. So I was tired. I wanted a break. And I took a year off and met Rob Havert, who's the managing partner and founder of Motive Partners. And he chased me around the world for about a year and persuaded me to join Motive in December of 2019. And the reason I joined Motive were as follows. First of all, the firm is focused exclusively on financial technology, so a space that I'm passionate about, really interested in. And it doesn't do anything else. And I think the sheer size of this space merits specialization. Secondly, Rob's vision, and it was more at that stage a vision, and it's now a reality, to give him credit. What's been built at Motive is actually delivered on this, but was to bring a new operating model to the way of doing private investing. And that was what we've come to now term the IOI model, which is shorthand for investor, operator, innovator. And in essence, that's what we do at Motive. We pursue thematically driven investments in our space, and we create value in those investments by deploying investment skills, of course, because those are table stakes. Added to that, deep and deeper than customary in-house operating experience and very extensive in-house technology and innovation capabilities. So we have many people who have been, like myself, decades of operations in the financial service or fintech space. Jeff Yabuki, our chairman, who was the chairman and chief executive of Fiserv for 15 years. Steve Daffron, who ran Interactive Data Corp and then Dun & Bradstreet and now Betanext. Richard Lum, who was the head of financial services for Accenture for many years. Bridget van Kralingen, who was the number two at IBM. I could go on, but you get the picture. Yeah. People with real operating chops who aren't just called in every now and again to ask for their opinion on such and such an investment. They're actually part of the origination process, part of the investment process, part of the portfolio management process, and in many cases go into the portfolio companies to act as executives. So Jeff is now the CEO of InvestCloud. Steve Daffron is running Betanext, having previously run Dun & Bradstreet for us, and so on. And what we find is that combined with extensive in-house technology capabilities, where we have about 170-ish full-time Motive people that are technologists that are deeply knowledgeable in everything from cloud deployment, microservices, APIs, go-to-market strategy, blockchain and cryptocurrencies and digital assets, ultra-personalization of services and AI, which is probably the biggest one. This extraordinary resource that not only do we use for underwriting and doing due diligence when we make an initial investment, but then actually ideating and executing, in some cases, value creation plans that are all technology-driven. This adds tremendous edge. It actually means that both investing at early stage, because we're stage agnostic, we do everything from incubation, venture, growth, and buyout, all the way from the very beginning to the grown-up phase of a company's life, having your finger on the pulse of technology innovation to a level that you're able to actually do it or prescribe doing it or help doing it is incredibly powerful for the entrepreneur that you're interacting with. And for us, it creates our edge. It means that fixer-uppers are less scary. Tech debt is less scary if you actually know what it takes to fix it. It means that you have confidence in employing new technologies defensively or offensively. And that edge that comes from that is what's unique. in the motif space. And for me, I thought that was genuinely properly differentiated from anything I'd ever heard from the private equity industry that I knew well because of years dealing with them at JP Morgan. Unbelievably incredible creators of value. But the playbook that was developed in private equity originally used to be buy cheap, deploy the maximum amount of leverage that you conceivably can tolerate at apparently almost no cost until recently, cut a lot of costs out of a poorly managed company to cut it to the bone, and then flip it into the wide open public equity markets that will embrace this with a couple of turns of multiple expansion, and you're done. That is a playbook, which I think I listed four items. I would say debatably all four of those things are not so true today. The buying cheap thing, yes, maybe. Some great companies are much cheaper than they were 2 years ago, but others are cheap for a reason. And there's a lot of dry powder chasing the good companies. So they're often not that cheap. Cutting costs for a living, most people have figured that out. And in a world where there's this much innovation going on, you're not going to cut costs to greatness any longer. That's not the reality. Cheap and free money, not true anymore. And then wide open public equity markets embracing youthful or improved companies, not so much. Yes, there are green shoots and a few IPOs are happening now, but that has not been the case. So in that context, you have to have a differentiated playbook. And thus, the case for specialization is greater. And the case for having operational chops and technology chops and having the ability to create value the hard way, which is by actually creating value, is what's needed. So that's what we try to do.
I'd love to break down the I, O, and I. Maybe we'll start with the innovation and tech piece. When you have that many people and you're deploying across many different stages, how do you differentiate the technical expertise your team has from supporting a company that needs to live on their own?
Yeah, good question. The answer is it's obviously not a one-size-fits-all. And we do have a playbook that is outlined for companies of different stages, but we don't stick entirely narrowly to those playbooks. Quite heavily depends on the nature of the company that you've bought. A microscopic startup very often doesn't have the resources to be paying third parties to do anything for it. There, we tend to provide much more input around fundraising, go-to-market, customer acquisition, strategic partnerships with other bigger companies and enterprise customers, many of whom are already in our network or our portfolios. Then if you buy something at the much more evolved end of the spectrum that is, say, an unloved, older, non-core, non-strategic asset that we carve out from a bigger company that has potentially a significant body of tech debt, there, the company will typically have its in-house technology capability. You need to be able to evaluate the talent there from the top on down. So we help people source great resources. We supplement that with our own where desired and appropriate. So people actually pay Motive to execute for them. And the difference between paying Motive to do that versus another consultant or integrator is two things. One is we charge modestly because we love our portfolio companies. More importantly, we have skin in the game. And so that's very appealing to many CEOs. And then there are companies that are in the advanced stages of growth that are wildly successful, going like rocket ships. Their rule of 70 companies, the sum of their growth and EBITDA margins are 70%, and they don't necessarily need any help at all from a technology point of view. Then along will come something like generative AI. When something like that comes along, we assess the risks and opportunities for every one of our portfolio companies. And then once that assessment is done, and it usually throws up revenue generating opportunity as well as cost avoidance, then we, in many cases, help execute that or help the company build the muscle memory so that they have the capability on a continuing basis to do that. So we second people and bring them back, we help them hire, or we just work on a project basis.
When you look at the operations, the O piece, and the operating partners you have, what is it about financial services that feels a little bit different from an operating partner in another private equity fund?
I think it's how we use those skills. My perception, never having been an operating partner elsewhere, is that operating partners tend to be somewhat passive until a specific opportunity comes up, and then they're brought in with that in mind. Our industry partners are responsible for driving industry and sector thesis work, so developing our views on what's going on in asset wealth management, banking, payments, and so on. They are responsible for originating transactions through their networks, all the way from venture to later stage opportunities. They're involved in working directly with the investment team and Motive Create on the due diligence and transaction evaluation process. And then they're part of the team that manages the portfolio company. And in some cases, that extends to being placed as a senior executive to run that company or be part of the C-suite somehow. Other cases, they're board members and operating from the outside in. But in all cases, they're very much a part of the company, and they're part of the way that we produce our product, of course, our product being returns for investors. So I would say that we use them much more extensively and intensively than would be customary.
And then if we turn to the investment side, I'd love to maybe talk through a theme and then how that plays through to different stages of investments.
We operate in four verticals and then loosely horizontal. So the verticals are insurance, technology, banking and payments, capital markets, and wealth management. And then the horizontal that cuts across some or all of those often is data and analytics, including obviously AI. To answer your question, the asset management and wealth technology space, which is an area where we have a very concretely defined and strong view. There are some mega trends afoot in that space that are being driven by demographics and technology and opening of architecture and all sorts of interesting things. So that has led us to be particularly active in recent years. Across all stages, we have, I think, 19 or 20 maybe now investments in businesses that are in the asset and wealth management technology space. Some of them are babies that you won't have heard of. Some of them are very prominent, indeed, even household names. So for example, we own Wilshire. We own Case, who operate a marketplace and technology platform for alternative investments. We own InvestCloud, which is a fully integrated end-to-end technology platform for wealth that handles everything from advisor to customer interaction all the way through to post-trade processing and SMAs and UMAs. We own BetaNext. It's not a household name, but you would notice if it broke. It provides the technology that runs self-clearing software for a very large part of the industry. Our thesis around wealth is the analogy to it is what happened in the world of advertising and search with the advent of Google, and what happened in the world of e-commerce and then cloud computing with the advent of Amazon. These are massive platforms that enable other people to conduct their business using those platforms. They generate enormous amounts of data as an exhaust, which has value in its own right. And they've revolutionized everything from supply chain to last mile delivery to advertising, the way you position businesses. It's extraordinary that hasn't happened to the same degree in the asset and wealth management space. It's extraordinary that we're being driven around today in autonomous vehicles on the streets. And yet we still haven't cracked T plus less than 2 settlements. Our view is that there's an absolutely extraordinary opportunity that is being fueled by this confluence of different technologies that are coming of age now simultaneously. But cloud computing was radically reducing the cost of data storage and compute, how APIs and microservices, smart contracts that auto-execute, the development of platform businesses that are foundational for third-party business, obviously big data, AI, generative AI, blockchain and its uses, and I shouldn't leave out quantum computing. So all of these technologies together are going to drive the enablement of enormous platform businesses that create significant value by eliminating inefficiencies, by developing the capability to deliver ultra-personalized service all the way to the level of the end investor at much lower cost than is possible today with much lighter touch. So that as new asset classes evolve and become opened up, such as the alternative space, it will take the process and the pain out of opening up access to these instruments, which have traditionally been the private domain of institutional investors and ultra, ultra, ultra high net worth investors, retail and just merely high net worth as a segment, very under allocated to alternatives. A typical allocation will be in the very low single digits, less than 3%. Institutional allocations are 20 to 30%. That's going to shift. But the cost of delivering that, executing that, it's not viable with the way that this business is done today. So the use of digital distribution channels, which will also become digital asset origination channels. So think you sell a fund through a digital platform to someone, a wealth group, and they want leverage against that fund position, which you can now provide. And now that's a source of private credit origination from the same platform. The ability to use AI to personalize and to help with education, which is a big issue for alternatives. And new products will evolve as well, too, that offer different liquidity profiles. Retail needs better liquidity than a 7-year private equity fund. So all of this is all being technology enabled. And what Motive's sort of ecosystem of investments in that space is building is an end-to-end capability where we can drive ultra-personalization, we can drive lower cost of execution, we can provide end-to-end straight-through processing. It doesn't mean we're going to merge every single one of our companies together, but it'll mean we'll help them integrate and provide services to each other. And the youngest companies who are doing things at the cutting edge are keeping the older companies informed and sometimes being tucked into those older companies to help renovate and drive forward an innovation agenda. What's really interesting, Rob Hayward, our managing partner, likes to call this ecosystem economics. And that's exactly what it is. It's that there's cross-sell opportunity, the synergies that we're able to deliver once you have a really well thought out thesis. It causes you to buy things that rhyme with each other and that have real opportunity to be better together.
When you walk across those different examples of portfolio companies mm-hmm. in the space, it's reasonable to think of how technology is going to apply as you're in the earlier stages. Yep. And then you mentioned something like Wilshire. And whether it's that particular company or you think of investment consulting, it's not synonymous with technology forward business. So I'm curious, just in an example like that, how do you apply that lens to a people-based, more staid business?
The people part of that business is super important, but supplementing it with the ability to perform sophisticated analytics, to use data to inform investment strategy, to create interfaces that allow for straight-through processing and communication, and that enable the institutional client to spend less time on the operations and more on the content of the substance. These are things that technology can help with, even in a human capital-intensive business. The ability to connect new product into that ecosystem as the sort of traditional portfolio allocation model is being ripped up and thought about, the 60-40 thing isn't going to fly any longer. And what is it going to look like? We're not totally sure yet, but it's certainly not going to be as simple as 60-40. But to have ways to deliver alternative investments and information about alternative investments through a Wilshire to their customer base, very important. A good example is another of our portfolio companies, Forge Global, who operates a market infrastructure for secondary private equity securities. It's developed an index product. Wilshire is eponymous with index products. It's an investable index product related to private equity securities that can now be allocated as part of a target portfolio allocation by an outsourced CIO.
So as you start connecting the dots across your four verticals, across the themes in this one ecosystem, as you look out over 3-5 years, what do you see happening with the investments you're making and the natural technology industry?
The world is just going to look very different in as little as 5 years' time. You're going to see advisor desktop space, which today is multiple different screens, the ops process and the email and this for public equities and that for fixed income and goodness knows what for the smorgasbord that is alternatives. That's all going to get integrated. The holy grail here is to get vastly greater productivity. If your objective is to deliver investment opportunity to more of the masses, you've got to find a way to do that at lower cost. So having technology capabilities that allow someone to invest $10 or $100 or $1,000 or even $100,000 in an instrument that typically has had a $500,000 minimum or $250,000 minimum is a significant development, but it can't be done the current way. It has to be done with automated education and resource support. So I think that in wealth, you're going to see that for sure. Almost all of the major wealth networks and even the smaller RIA type platforms and their aggregators suffer with fragmented technology estates and in many cases, aging technology estates and clunky integrations or no integrations. And they're still dealing with faxes and emails and crazy things that they should not have to be dealing with. That will radically change the economics of their doing business. That's happening as we speak. One area I'm very interested in that's a risk to this vision, the cyber risk associated with an increasingly digitized world is obviously enormous. So these risks are significant. And in a world where we're more digitally interconnected, obviously the risk goes up and the risk to violation of privacy and intrusion at an individual level, but institutional and systemic risk also goes up. Now imagine a world where bad guys, individual criminals, nation states, whatever, are armed with quantum computing and AI. The juxtaposition of these two is super powerful. The ability to ultra-personalize phishing attacks, just as you might ultra-personalize exquisite customer service, is just as possible to do bad things with it as with good. With quantum computing, the particular risk is the ability of quantum computers to defeat the algorithms we use to encrypt data. And the world has only just begun to really grown up about properly encrypting data. We're encrypting data using linear algorithms that are trivially defeatable with commercially viable quantum computers. That should scare you, because if we're not prepared for that adequately, the implications could be truly pretty diabolical. Now, the good news is that although quantum computers debatably do not yet exist in a commercially viable form, the math exists to encrypt data to a degree that nonlinear encryption algorithms that would be impervious to attack by quantum computing. The scale of the transformation and the data exercise needed to convert data to being encrypted in a quantum resilient cryptographic way is very important and I think increasingly pressing area. I like thinking about where are the sort of black swans that could come out of the woodwork and surprise us, and this is definitely one of them.
Among your other theses outside of wealth management, what are you most excited about?
Capital markets is an arena where the trading and execution end of the capital market space has been radically transformed over the past years. But what's interesting in capital markets is the post-trade is still a mess. And also that, just like I described in the asset and wealth space, there aren't that many real platform businesses that are ubiquitous and that are excellent and that are cloud native and that are efficient and that are modular and that can be evolved to fit the needs of diverse and disparate customers. Instead, you find in capital markets many businesses that are burdened with legacy technology, often written in languages like COBOL that they don't even teach in schools any longer, millions of lines of code that are expensive to address. And a lot of these providers are very entrenched. Their clients are very costly to move off these capabilities. But the case for doing that is increasing and increasing because the cost of operating in capital markets, especially in light of a world where capital requirements are going up, and so the imperative of operating efficiently in order to generate an appropriate return on capital deployed is increasing. In a world where money was priced at zero or negative interest rates, it didn't really matter that stuff was slow. It really matters that stuff is slow when there's a time value associated with money. So lots of opportunity there to really build new and interesting capabilities in and around the capital market space. Banking and payments, the consumer payments business domestically and most of the developed world is ultra competitive, but all sorts of opportunities, especially in cross-border payments and remittances, which are still astonishingly inefficient and fragmented. Significant opportunities to improve digital identity, which has implications for KYC AML at the individual level, but also digital identity for entities and institutions. Lots of opportunity there.
Blythe, I want to get a chance to ask you a couple of closing questions. What is your favorite hobby or activity outside of work and family?
I'm a horse person. I've been an avid pony girl since I was growing up in the pony club in England and took a few years off, but I started again after I had my daughter in my 20s. And I've been riding ever since. I still compete to this day. I don't practice enough. Riding a 1,500-pound animal over 4-foot 6 fences is not particularly advisable at the best of times, but without practice is definitely not a good idea. But it's a hobby that I'm passionate about. I love my horses, and I live here in Florida, and I have a farm in Wellington where I actually have the privilege of living on my own farm with my own horses. So I can get off a Zoom and get on a horse and not even have to leave the property. It's great.
What's one fact that most people don't know about you?
Maybe it's a story about my dad. My dad, who's passed away many years ago now, joined the Royal Air Force in Britain before the Second World War and evolved an instructor of fighter pilots and trained countless young pilots who fought in the air war against Germany and others. He was frustrated by the fact that as an instructor, he was prevented from participating in combat throughout the whole Second World War. He also had become aware of the Holocaust and became a very vocal opponent of the British government's foreign policy towards Palestine. And his view was that, particularly in light of what had happened in the Holocaust, this was an unforgivable act by Britain. And so he volunteered as an unpaid, non-Jewish Gentile who showed up, approached the Israeli government, who were convinced immediately that he was a spy for the British government, which he wasn't. They took him anyway, and he became part of the orchestration of a plan that helped Israel with its first Air Force defense capabilities, which was created by flying by hook or by crook, illegally, under the cover of darkness, behind the mountain, under the radar, to behind the Iron Curtain, the new emerging Iron Curtain in Europe, to places like Czechoslovakia, where they bought, stole, bartered, goodness knows what, pieces of surplus equipment, aircraft that had been abandoned by the Nazis and the Russians, took those pieces of aircraft, flew them back, a great danger to themselves, back and forth for many months, and accumulated enough stuff to be able to build a homemade air force. And so that became Israeli 101 Squadron, which my dad then fought in as a fighter pilot. He was a squadron leader. He flew with Asa Weitzman, who was the head of 101 Squadron, who subsequently became the president of Israel. And dad was a bit of a hero in the creation of what is now the Israeli state. It's not really about me, it's about my dad, but I think it's interesting.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
Probably the most annoyed I get on a regular basis is the inability quickly to get the news in an unbiased fashion. And this is true all over the world, but it used to be you would turn on one news source and you're reasonably confident that you could get your news. But you have to really work to get unbiased news today. It drives me nuts.
Which two people have had the biggest impact on your professional life?
So Phil Demchak has to be one of them. He is presently the CEO, what not surprisingly is one of the most successful banks in the United States, PNC. Brilliant man. I worked for him for many years at JP Morgan, and he was responsible in many ways for pressing me to do new and different things. And he constantly challenged me. He was a critical boss, but he was irritatingly usually right. He was an exceptional leader and he gathered a group of extraordinary people around him, and that drove a lot of innovation. So he was one. I would say watching Jamie at work has obviously been an interesting lesson. I want to say three because I just feel I ought to, but I would say Rob Habert, albeit that his influence has only been felt in the last 5 years of my career. I've found a home at Motive that I really love. I'm getting to do really interesting things and do stuff again in a really different way. And Rob's vision created that.
What's the best advice you've ever received?
It probably was when I was younger, much younger, I was still a kid, I would act in school productions. And I suffered the worst terrible stage fright. And the advice I got, which had to do with managing nerves and managing fear, there's a book about it actually. It's called How to Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And you'd be amazed, even though that original advice was about how to manage stage fright, you'd be amazed the number of situations where it's good advice in personal life and in professional life. It's helped me do things that are hard. It's scary. Because when you get asked to do something you don't know how to do or you haven't done before and you have to let go something that you really know and love and is getting easy, it's hard to do that. But that sort of notion, get over it and turn the fear into motivation, has been actually, I think, very helpful. I think also acknowledging that fear exists, which most of the time is completely unacceptable on Wall Street, has been helpful to me because it does exist. And anyone that tells you it doesn't is either a sociopath or is lying.
All right, Blythe, last one. What life lesson have you learned that you wish you knew a lot earlier in life?
It's got something to do with the fact that most of the things that really annoy you about other people, professionally or personally, say a lot more about you than they do about them. And it takes a while to learn that. And when you do, life changes.
Blythe, thanks so much for taking the time.
Real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show. To learn more, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can join our mailing list, access past shows, learn about our gatherings, and sign up for premium content, including podcast transcripts, my investment portfolio, and a lot more. Have a good one, and see you next time.